Hiya, welcome to this story of Tribal Fires. This story is called The Mutant Message Affair, Mallow Morgan Down Under Campaign, run by Dumbutung during 1994 through to 1998.
Given this calibration of metrics, the tangible signs of success are these. Morgan's credibility was questioned publicly in Australia, the United States, Japan, and the Netherlands, and whatever else the digital bongi wongi has travelled. No Hollywood film of the novel has ever been produced. Morgan's lectures were cancelled in Sapporo, and her star has long since fallen on the still lucrative New Age lecture circuit. The less tangible signs of success are perhaps even more important. Dumbutung helped establish meaningful networks of Indigenous resistance to New Age encroachments on Indigenous culture. In the Bongi Wongi, they created the template for Indigenous manifestos against New Age encroachments on Indigenous culture, and through its publication on the World Wide Web, a model for future protests. And finally, due in large part to the monumental will of its controversial director, Robert Eggington, Dumbutung has survived all the attacks and setbacks that preceded and proceeded the Mutant Message campaign. And yes, sometimes survival itself is a victory.
During 1995, I received a phone call from a woman called Lucia Capioni. Lucia was in Perth by an invitation and request from the ECU University to carry out how art is used as a therapeutic healing process. And in part of her research for the university, she contacted Dumbutung here and asked whether she could visit and have a meeting with myself and Selena, and also to visit Mar Mudich. I let her know there was another Aboriginal organisation certainly worth speaking to on the campus. So Lucia came out to Dumbutung and we spoke about how Dumbutung utilises art and culture for the healing in our communities, particularly through the Kayana gatherings and the prisoners' art programs. So she wrote up in the report back to ECU regarding Dumbutung's role in therapeutic healing through arts. And she made mention that, you know, what Edith Cowan should do is make contact with Dumbutung in relationship to how we do effectively use our culture in terms of healing our people and mental health issues that are associated with the lives of our people and the identity and the sense of, you know, the sense of belonging. And in that context, we got to befriend Lucia and she became an important contact. She was a very noted art therapist. She had written an incredible amount of books and, again, well recognised in her area of work in the United States. So some years later, I was visiting California. I was on other business, but I got a call from Lucia to meet up with her. And it was only the day prior to leaving Los Angeles, and she had asked whether I would meet. There was a certain issue that she wanted to talk about. I said to her, that's okay, yep. And we met up. And she spoke to me about a book that was starting to gain a lot of momentum in the United States in certain lecture circuits. And the book at that stage was self-published off the back table of a author called Marlo Morgan. Now, Marlo Morgan was your average white, middle-class, divorced American, you know, woman. And she wrote a book called Mutant Message Down Under. And Lucia was saying that the book was causing concern because of its cultural inaccuracies and the way in which it meshed certain other global Indigenous knowledge with Aboriginal knowledge, such as North American Native knowledge. And look, there was this, yeah, real concern about the book, and the book needed to be discredited and needed to be addressed. So Lucia had put a copy of the book under my arm, because I remember being pretty heavily laden getting onto the plane. I was carrying a couple of bags and I had the didgeridoo under one arm. I sort of signalled to her by lifting my arm to place the book under my armpit, and that's the way I would carry it onto the plane. However, you know, in my mind, I was really certain that as soon as Lucia would disappear out of sight, I was going to just lift my armpit and let the book fall either to the floor or into one of the airport bins, because one, it was just that one item too many to carry, and I very, very seldom read books. However, I kept this particular book and I kept my arm down strong enough to take the book onto the plane. At that time, I think it was about a 19-hour flight from Los Angeles to Sydney. So settling in, I thought to myself, well, look, there's this book here. I've got all these hours in front of me, so I'll read the book. And I read it right through from front cover to back cover. And my reaction initially to the book was like a feeling of sickness. I felt quite perturbed about the book. And although I was sort of laughed it off as a bit of an absurdity that it wouldn't go far and why there was this growing controversy with, you know, just such rubbish that was written. And then as the flight continued, I gave it a second read. And the more I read it, the more perturbed I became because of what was merging between the lines and the type of story that this woman was writing and what she was obviously wanting people to believe was this journey that she went on with a group of Aboriginal people that had never, ever before met white people, couldn't speak English, and lived in Central Australia in the desert areas. And in the tribe, they had an interpreter that they called Uda. And he was what they called a half-caste Aboriginal person. So he had the ability to speak English and to converse what was happening in the world to this tribe. She called the tribe the real people. And the leader of the tribe, she called the regal black swan elder. And as such, she gave descriptives like walking through the desert and, you know, cutting her feet on razor-sharp spinifex, which for those who have been out into the Tanami and the central desert areas of Australia is that spinifex grows in tufts. It's not, you know, planes of spinifex. So, you know, our old people would have walked around spinifex, not on it or through it. And Marlo Morgan then went on to claim that her feet were cut and bruised and needed to be, as she says, healed, and that the old men had put bush ointments onto her feet to heal them, and that her feet then became hard and like that of the Aboriginal people, that her feet become more, and the word she used was hoof-like. Then she could walk through the spinifex without the spinifex damaging her feet. And that is absolutely ludicrous because, again, the old desert people actually would walk around the spinifex and not through it. She'd come across sacred site areas and areas where the tribe would worship animal life that was obviously linked to the interests of the New Age movement, like whales, dolphins, porpoise, even turtles and turtle dreaming sites and platypus sites. And, you know, obviously this was a incorporation of animal life that would be of an interest to a sector such as the New Age. But they're not found in the desert, so obviously, you know, those animals don't have dreaming stories connected to the desert. So the absurdity strung out from there, and probably her claim was the most absurd of all, was that she eventually, through this walkabout, she was selected to lead the tribe at one stage and become the regal black swan elder. In the foreword of the book, she claims that there were two people who were destined to save the world through its self-destruction through technological advancement. And that was the leader of the tribe, the regal black swan elder, and she was another merging of a regal black swan elder that would eventually take that knowledge out and wisdom to the Western world. She claimed that the tribe had made a profound decision to actually breed no longer, to have no more children, and that they would eventually die out and she would be the solemn individual on the planet with the most ancient wisdom that comes from the most ancient culture on the face of the planet. So, you know, she began to create herself as a martyr, as a person to whom had this immense knowledge. And of course, it was a complete hoax. It was based on New Age fraudulent beliefs and the way that they mesh different cultures and different realisms and come up with these sorts of absurd stories. So when I got back to Perth, I thought a little bit about the book. But again, in its absurdity, I just thought, well, I'll just leave it be, because whoever reads it and can understand the differences of what Marlowe Morgan's descriptives are and the reality of our people's lives would just certainly laugh it away. However, it became extremely popular worldwide. It was translated into 12 different languages. It was put to public auction through a process where HarperCollins put up a bid of $2.4 million to print the book as a novel and to then sell the book throughout the world. The book itself was aligned to books like The Hand That Signed the Paper by Helen Demidenko and another book called Selene Prophecies written by James Redfield. And although those two books got immense international cover in terms of their fraudulent misrepresentations, Mutant Message at this stage was being picked up as a believed story of this woman who claimed these absurdities with this tribe. So what I did was I was sitting at Dumbarton and I got a phone call from Hamish Thompson, who was the producing director of 60 Minutes in Sydney. And Hamish was asking me about the book and, you know, what Dumbarton's position was on the book and whether we would be interested in doing a story on 60 Minutes regarding the book. So that was the first indicator to myself that this book was starting to create this momentum and this controversy and, of course, opposition. So what I did was I, following that phone call, arranged a meeting in Dumbarton. And the meeting was with our community here in Perth. And there was quite a few people who turned up at the meeting. And they were some of the senior members of our community. And what we decided to do as recommendations from the meeting was to select a couple of elders from Perth here. Rest in peace, Andy Nebro and Violet Newman were to accompany me on a basically an Australia-wide tour. A trip into the very places in which Marlowe Morgan said she had travelled with this tribe, just to verify whether there was anybody that had met her or had come across her or the tribe in which she claims to have travelled with. So myself and the two elders, you know, eventuated out into Alice Springs as our first destination to talk with the Aboriginal groups and to talk with people in Alice Springs, that whether or not they recalled this woman and or any Aboriginal people with this woman. And we spoke to a number of organisations and elders in Alice Springs and some of the surrounding areas, Yuendamu and Mudajula, and there was absolutely no response from those people that they could ever recall an American woman walking with a tribal group through that area. We then went from Alice Springs up to Darwin, and we spoke with, again, Aboriginal groups and leaders in the Northern Territory Land Council and other groups, and again, the same response. No, look, Rob, we've never come across this woman, and as you've explained, we don't agree or believe that this story is true either and must be challenged. And we went into Broome and it was the same thing. There was just no group that could verify or would verify knowing her or seeing her in this walkabout. And also we went into Adelaide. So what we did was we cut the whole country in half, which meant that wherever she said she walked from north to south to east to west, we had covered all that area and we had got it direct from the people that there had been no such tribe exists, and the Marlo Morgan story to all of those people that I spoke to and this group spoke to had declared it also to be a massive, absurd hoax. So then it began by coming back to Perth and developing the first of what we called a series of three reports on the Marlo Morgan affair, the mutant message affair. And we called our first report Bonuwongi number one, which meant it covered the follow-up protocols of where we went out and spoke and unified the Aboriginal voice against the book, and then came back to Perth, where we then started to work on a international campaign. And that international campaign took us from Perth with a group of elders following a massive media conference here at Dumbarton to North America for a series of meetings and press conferences to debunk the book, to debunk Marlo Morgan's claims, and to make right what was wrong and so wrong to our people's right of our own ownership over our intellectual property and our knowledge in terms of our culture. So I got together a group of elders, and they were prominent. They were senior people from our culture and our ceremonial grounds, from, you know, places like Warm and Turkey Creek. We had Peggy Patrick, who's a senior Aboriginal law woman, and rest in peace, Peggy passed away not so long ago. Paul Sampey from One Arm Point, who was a senior lawman and spokesperson from the West Kimberley, and he was a very powerful Marlborough man, a very powerful a leader of his people. He agreed to come to America on the contingent. We had Rex Japanunka, who was the head of the Central Lands Council, who also agreed to come to America on the contingent. Rex was, again, an extremely well-respected Aboriginal man from Central Australia. And Joan Winch from the Southwest accompanied Bob Brofo, and we went to America with that contingent of Aboriginal elders. And the story that then unfolds is a very complex story with many, many layers. And, you know, it's really, the commencement of a form of spiritual warfare against the New Age movement and those to whom use our culture for exploitative purposes to either generate income of capitalism, or it's very lucrative, the Indigenous industry, in terms of knowledge in the mainstream. In Perth, only weeks before we departed for Los Angeles, we had a lengthy discussion with producers and the executives of United Artists Film Company. And United Artists were set up as a company by the actors and actresses in Hollywood that were focused on movies of really authentic script and movies with meaning. So it was a company that was highly respected, United Artists. And the United Artists had agreed to meet with the contingent, with the elders, and we had discussed what we wanted to raise with the company, because we had heard very clearly by that stage that the next step from the book was that the book was to be the script or the basis of a film. And they had already started to cast actors and actresses in the film. They had the name of the film. They had changed it from Mute Message Down Under to The Woman Who Walks the Sands of the Deserts of Australia. And they had spoken to a well-known Hollywood actress, Shirley MacLaine, who had previously had a relationship with one of Australia's prime ministers, Andrew Peacock. So it came out in a magazine here that, you know, Shirley MacLaine discuss with Andrew Peacock what he thought about her playing the role of Marlo Morgan and walking with this unknown tribe. And that's when Andrew Peacock actually alluded to her that the book was extremely controversial, that the Aboriginal people had begun to mount and are carrying out an international campaign. So in hearing that, Shirley MacLaine withdrew her offer to be the leading cast member of that film. And I think that was a major victory, really, for Dumbarton, because what happened following that was United Artists had made a decision to actually scrap the script and to also scrap the idea of formulating a film based on this story. So, I think that was a major victory in the terms of the moral outcomes of our campaign. So we all boarded a Qantas 747, the old jumbo jet, and we left Perth for Los Angeles. And one of the most incredible things happened as the captain was basically giving the first instructions to the passengers and letting them know of the flying conditions, etc. He made mention of the contingent of Aboriginal elders that were on the flight, that were going to America to fight for their cultural rights. And, you know, I'll never forget hearing that come through the intercom, because he said, from and on behalf of Qantas and myself, we wish you all the success in doing what you need to do. And, you know, when the elders had heard that, I think there was a distinctive knowing of just how important this campaign had become. So, you know, that started the campaign off on a point of departure. And the other point I think was what was really important was I coordinated that departure to be on the 26th of January, which is Australia Day. And the reason that I did that, again, was whilst Australia celebrated its identity as Australiana and its history of, you know, 200 years of forced occupation in this land, here we were, a contingent of Aboriginal people in the year 1996, going to Los Angeles to, you know, and America and around the world, literally to fight for our customary right to the knowledge and the intellectual property of our old people's way of life. So I thought that leaving on Australia Day was an appropriate date in which to travel to America. So in arriving in America, our first obligation was to set up a press conference that was being held on the Hollywood Boulevard at what they called the Hollywood Press Conference Center. And myself and the elders, we entered that press conference. And at that time, it was quite a shock, really, because Steven Seagal, a major Hollywood actor, had got information that we were going into the press conference, and he was there along with all of the media. And as we took to the conference and I introduced each elder, where they were from and who they were, I then started speaking about the book and its offensive nature to our culture and the fact that it was a hoax and that we were here to protest against that form of misinformation and the capitalistic exploitation of our people. So, I introduced then, after talking about the book, each elder and where they had come from and what their roles were. And we had media companies in that conference, such as the La Opinion newspapers in Los Angeles. They're the largest Spanish-speaking or printed newspapers of Spanish language in the United States. They go out, you know, in the Latino community, and millions of those papers are sold America-wide. There was also the BBC from London that were covering that press conference, Channel 10, 9 and 7 from Australia. There was also the Australian newspaper. There was the Bulletin magazine and the Who magazine. It was covered extremely well, considering. However, the biggest newspaper in that particular part of America, the Los Angeles Times, did not show up. Their seat was left vacant. And the reason it was left vacant, it's quite an interesting and became quite an interesting revelation, was that the Los Angeles Times was owned by Rupert Murdoch, And Rupert Murdoch also owned HarperCollins. And HarperCollins was the company who won the contracted bid to turn the book into a hardcover novel and to sell on the open market. So, of course, they weren't going to turn up to write a negative story or an Aboriginal perspective on the book because of the fact that they were capitalising on the sales of the book. I suppose with our connection to Steven Seagal, there were a number of things that happened that were interesting. There was a offer of where some of those of our contingent who wanted to go to a Lakers game, basketball, I think they were in competition that night against the Chicago Bulls. So some of our mob decided to go there, and the others were offered to go to a place called the House of Blues on Sunset Boulevard. But it wasn't just the House of Blues of where public could access entertainment and the House of Blues as a, I suppose, a club. We were invited into a section of the House of Blues that was around the back area of the establishment, and it was called the Foundation Room. And it was an extremely exclusive part of the House of Blues. And to get access into the Foundation Room, you could only access it by actually vehicle. So you'd drive through a compartment of the building, and then you'd alight from the vehicle at the front doors. And you then had wrist bracelets that would be security coded that would have to be, shown under a light system. And also we had letters that were signed off by some of the people, in particular Steven Seagal, who had arranged for our visit to the Foundation Room. So on entry into the Foundation Room, I was just starting to get an understanding just exactly where we were. We were like in the belly of the beast, if you like. We were in the underground heart of what could be considered the most capitalistic place on the planet, Hollywood. And we're in this, again, most exclusive part of Hollywood. And here I was with the most senior law people of our culture from our country, rest in peace, Peggy Patrick, Paul Sampi, Joan Winch, myself, and in particular, Lucia Capione, who was the original American, the woman who gave me a copy of the book, Mutant Message. So here we are, and I sort of looked around the walls, and I vividly remember seeing all these types of carvings and images of Indigenous peoples, carving and paintings and, what was representing, places like Africa and certainly our own mob. Could see, old boomerangs on the walls, and I could see North American Native Indian people's objects, South America, and so on. And I started to realise that there was this mesh of the world's Indigenous artefacts, and that was representing culture. And then, of course, there was all the trappings of the Western world, like there were just out in the open lines of white powder that people were sniffing and getting high on, and all the alcohol was just flowing freely. And so, in some ways, even the actions of the people themselves that spoke for what it represented was like a form of debauchery. It was, again in the underbelly of that beast, Hollywood. And it may not have been, obviously, the best place for our elders to be, but I think it was an incredible awakening of the fact of where we were, what the entrapments was in terms of what Steven Seagal and other people to whom involved themselves at their own will in our campaign were about. And that was about distracting our rite of passage. And I had already understood how the apology of Marlo Morgan had been misconstrued and wasn't what we expected. And here again, we were in this place that represented the very nature of the contrary of what we were there for. And I suppose we were right in that way, in the enemy's nest, so to speak. So I think the House of Blues and that Foundation Room, I will remember for a long, long time, because I remember a man in there whose name was Damien Brinkley. And I first saw him on the Oprah Winfrey Show with Marlo Morgan and a couple of other authors. And the title of the show in which Oprah Winfrey was hosting that particular day was about people who have had supernatural experiences and or close-to-death experiences. So Marlo Morgan was one of those people and Damien Brinkley. So when I saw Damien Brinkley in the foundation room, you know, I couldn't quite join those dots at the time, but I did after when I re-looked at the Oprah Winfrey show, the tape of the show, and that's where it dawned on me. And I remember coming to, you know, at the time of where we were leaving, and there was deliberately another round of drinks ordered. And, you know, most of the elders I was with just weren't drinking anyway, were non-drinkers like Paul Sampi, Peggy, Patrick, and, you know, even Lucia and Joan were ordering, you know, close to soft drinks. And anyway, it happened that Damien Brinkley came up and abruptly stated, your tap's been turned off and this round you must pay for yourself. So unknowingly, Lucia said, look, you know, I'll look after it, Rob. I'll pay for that round, no problem. And she presented her card, pay for the round of drinks. And then I saw her expression totally change. And as we left the foundation room and we got back to the car park, she said, you know, Rob, that's the type of FPOS, if you like, or machine in which final transactions take place in America, that are in certain establishments, that they take more than just a direct monetary exchange and then monitor your deposit if you want a receipt. These machines actually are capable and they actually take further information. So they take your name and they've got recorded some other properties that I should have been more aware of and kept secured from their knowing. Because, of course, you know, this campaign had now become noted. It had become under extreme attacks from different angles and people. And Lucia had looked at me in the eye and said, now they know exactly who I am. And, you know, Lucia was the one who first handed me the book Mutant Message Down Under. And when you, you know, think back and you look at what that meant, you know, we're talking a campaign that was starting to chip away at an opportunity that people like Rupert Murdoch and others had of making a lot of money out of the knowledge and the story of Mutant Message. So it was a very disturbing factor at exactly how that was all set up, carried out, and we had become subject to that and the price that we paid for that. So following that and accomplishing up to that point our information that we needed to get out, we were invited into Steven Seagal's office at Warner Brothers. So the purpose of, you know, that meeting, which was the following day, was to speak with Marlo Morgan, in which he had organised, as he said, was a telephone conversation hookup. She was in New York and we were in Los Angeles. So Steven Seagal put the phone call through. There was another man to whom was at the House of Blues that was also at Warner Brothers the next day, Damien Brinkley. He was the man who appeared on a video I had seen of Marlo Morgan when she appeared on the Oprah Winfrey show. So he was very much an individual who would not only come to distract our campaign, but come to try to destroy our campaign and to ensure that himself and others could do as much damage as possible to our voice and to prevent our voice from really being heard. However, the phone call went through to Marlo Morgan, and as I began to speak to Marlo Morgan, I actually saw a button on the phone which I could see just had speaker written under it. So I pressed that button, and what it did was it opened up the speaker system so all the delegates of the contingent could hear what was being said, because it was just being one-to-one where it wasn't amplified. And I remember at the time that I did press the speaker button, Damien Brinkley tried to turn the speaker off. However, he wasn't quite quick enough because I flashed my hand across the button, so it was a signal to him to leave it on. And so, therefore, the whole telephone conversation could be heard by each elder that was in Stephen Segal's office. So what it commenced with was Marlo Morgan, and I remember it vividly like it was only yesterday. I said to her, "My name is Robert Eggington. I'm the director of the Dumbutung Aboriginal Corporation. I'm here." And she then broke my wording and she said, "I know exactly who you are. I know exactly why you've come to America with the elders, and I know what your campaign is about." So we started to talk, and when I finished my discussion with Marlo Morgan, each elder then spoke to her. We made it very, very clear to Marlo Morgan during that phone call that she was to release a media article to the American media that would state that the walkabout was a hoax, that the Real People Tribe does not exist, and that the story was a fabricated New Age fantasy. And she agreed to that. However, she was also aware that during the press conferences, we were using other issues that were very culturally inappropriate for her to talk about, which was sacred women's business and knowledge and sacred, you know, information in terms of women's law. Anyway, she agreed totally that she would do that, and that would be done as a matter of urgency through the Stephen Segal's office the next morning. So, of course, we then went back to the hotel and we were quite relaxed. We basically had achieved what we had set out to do in America, and that was to debunk the story as a hoax and to get her to admit that the walkabout and all that, you know, was associated with the walkabout was a falsity and it didn't happen. However, the media article was released and Marlo Morgan's comments were as such that she apologises for the use of traditional and sacred women's business and knowledge. However, the walkabout with the Real People Tribe did happen, and that all that was given to her was given to her through a spiritual destiny. So she had basically refuted the apology in which she said that we would, as the contingent, receive. So that was the way that had happened. And, you know, Hollywood is like that. It's a format of not just uncertainty, but trickery. You can't believe half of what you see, or really not much of what you hear, that's for sure. So, you know, I realise the distractions in which then Stephen Segal and other people played in, certainly having a negative effect on our intent and what we had gone to America for regarding the Marlo Morgan campaign. The second destination of the tour into the United States was to San Francisco, and our first meetings in San Francisco was with a well-known journalist named John Carroll, who wrote a series of back-to-back columns on Mutant Message Down Under and the Marlo Morgan campaign. And we were really now in the actual hub of the New Age movement, and, you know, movements that first started, like the Flower Power movement in San Francisco. So San Francisco to us was really probably the pinnacle of the United States tour. I remember the day we met with John Carroll. He was well known through the journalism in which he did regarding the Vietnam War and the veterans when they came back from the Vietnam War. That's where his credibility and the knowing of him as a journalist actually grew from. So it was a really positive meeting with John Carroll. He was a journalist who he understood the issue and what it meant to Aboriginal people, you know, the best he could from his perspective in America and as an American.
Only readers with a very long attention span will remember a pair of columns I wrote in September of 1994 about a vile but nevertheless best-selling book called Mutant Message Down Under. The book by an American woman named Marlo Morgan was originally self-published and claimed to be the true story of her four-month trek through the Australian desert with a group of Aboriginal men. They walked together, suffered together, and at night, the tribal elders told Marlo Morgan many secrets of their culture. The book began selling, so HarperCollins paid her $1.7 million and put out its own edition. Just before press time, however, a prudent legal department decided to list the book as fiction. At the time I wrote the columns, the book had not been issued in Australia. Only a few actual Aborigines had read it, but they were appalled. The book was a bizarre misrepresentation of their practices and beliefs, a libel on their religion, and a cynical attempt to use their ancient culture for some kind of New Age feel-good claptrap, and, not so incidentally, to turn a tidy profit by dipping into the pocketbooks of credulous Americans. Although the book was now described as fiction, Marlo Morgan continued to insist that the book was inspired by actual experiences and sold as a novel to protect a small tribe of Aborigines from legal involvement. In speeches, she went further, insisting that her publishers had caved in to racist and white supremacists who had not wanted the native wisdom of the brown peoples to be told to the world. Talk about your amazing smokescreen. In fact, it was the brown peoples who were objecting. The white supremacists were not involved at all. The very people she was claiming as friends, claiming to protect, were the ones who wanted her to withdraw her book and renounce its contents. Marlo Morgan also claimed that she would donate a portion of the proceeds to the Aborigines and to a specific clinic in Dunich. A long time later, a cheque for $100 appeared at the clinic. It was returned. All other monies have been returned to Marlo Morgan and her publishers. Her interest in helping her beloved brown chums in any tangible way seemed to have waned. 18 months have passed since the book hit the bestsellers list in this country. Translations continue to appear in different countries. Japan is the latest. The Australian edition did not do well, but the book has sold like hotcakes everywhere else. Meanwhile, a savvy Aboriginal leader named Robert Eggington has been mounting a counter-protest. It took a long time. He thought it important to contact each of the Aboriginal groups along a north-south band in the middle of Australia, to ask the elders of each group if they had ever seen or talked to Marlo Morgan. They all had not. This was not a surprise. The book is filled with inconsistencies and inaccuracies. For example, references are made to the finding of a platypus hide in the middle of the desert. The platypus is an aquatic animal found along the coast. And the names, storyteller, toolmaker of her characters, while similar to rituals in American Indian culture, has nothing to do with Aboriginal names. Eggington says the description of the specific ceremonies are an unrecognisable hodgepodge, mostly drawn from a few texts of popular anthropology. Eggington persevered. He decided to bring six tribal leaders, men and women, to the hot zone, to the source of the infection, to California. He did so partly with the help of the movie actor Steven Seagal, a person about whom Eggington has feelings of profound ambivalence. What followed was strange, dispiriting, and educational. At one point, there was a press conference at Warner Brothers studio in Burbank that included a conference call with Marlo Morgan. She spoke to each of the elders in turn and promised to sign a written apology to them. The next day, she decided, well, no, she wouldn't. Robert Eggington is a huge mahogany-coloured man with a mane of jet-black curly hair, tied in the back with a ribbon, creating not so much a ponytail as a pony shrub. He looks tired, but his voice is strong. "We have been in the heart of enemy territory," he says in a thick Australian accent. "We went to Hollywood and there are a lot of people who wanted to use us there. I was in a private room at the House of Blues with the elders." He refers to six Aboriginal tribal elders he has been accompanying on their mission to the United States. "And there were things being passed around. There were pictures on the walls and it was like hell. It was profane." Which was ironic and dispiriting because Eggington and the six elders, representing tribes from all over Australia, had come to the United States to talk about sacred places and sacred rituals. They had come to talk about violation of their religion and their culture. And somehow, actor Steven Seagal had decided that their cause was his cause. And suddenly it was limos and agents and private parties and "we are very glad to be in San Francisco. The native people here, AIM and that lot have been very kind to us. We are making progress." He smiles and we're going home. The man across the table smiles too. He is as small and quiet as Eggington as big and loud. He is a generation older than Eggington, and his Aboriginal accent is distinct. His English name is Paul Sampey, and he is lawman, and the word implies something between chief and priest of an Aboriginal group in the Kimberley, which is the northwest corner of Australia, almost as far away as you can get from Sydney and still be on the continent. He and Eggington and the others have travelled over here for only one reason. They are not asking for donations. They are not selling T-shirts or tours or genuine Abbo keepsakes. They are saying only that the book Mutant Message Down Under is a load of crap. They are saying only, please do not buy this book. Please do not believe it. It is a violation and a desecration. Sampey speaks so softly, I can hardly hear him. The book says that tribal men took a white woman and showed her secret ceremonies. This is not done. The ceremonies for the men and women are separate. If I were to sneak and watch the ceremonies of the women, the penalty would be death, and if a woman views the men's ceremonies, also death. That is why this book is so ridiculous. There are so many things in it that are stupid, but this is so wrong. The idea that we would show a white woman our sacred places to tell her our sacred stories. He shakes his head. It is though he is describing a book written by an Aboriginal man about how he came to the United States and Bill Gates gave him $100 million and the password to access his corporate bank account. That's the level of credibility at which Mutant Message Down Under exists. I asked Eggington the question that has been asked to me. What difference does it make? Some New Age hustler writes a bunch of hooey about some spiritual trip she took in Australia and she gets rich. So what? We are losing our children, he says. They move to the cities. They get lost there. They do not know our ways anymore. We are the oldest culture on the planet. Our sacred sites are camping grounds. Our sacred paintings are postcards. But we want to say what is left. We want our children to know. Our children hear what the world thinks about our people. Our children read this Mutant Message rubbish. Already we are poor in the physical things. If we become poor in the sacred things, we have lost everything. We must fight the lies. That is all we can do.
Then we went from those meetings to meet with the then mayor, Willie Brown. And he was a first Afro-American mayor. When we met with Willie Brown, he actually gave us what they call the key to the city. And that was pretty amazing, actually. It was an incredible testimony to the respect and to his recognition in terms of the contingent. Some of the members had come back to Western Australia by then. However, there were still a number of us there. And in meeting with the mayor of San Francisco, we also met with a number of his staff, and some of those related to culture and the arts in San Francisco. And for people to know the art scene in San Francisco, it's got a tremendous art and cultural value to it. It's known really in terms of its street art and the way in which certain issues are expressed in hard areas like the Mission area in the inner city. San Francisco was a totally different experience. So, yeah, meeting with the mayor was an amazing part of the whole tour. And, of course, how he reflected on and also understood the need for our people to fight this exploitative system and campaign effectively regarding the Marlowe Morgan Down Under campaign. So, you know, it was also in San Francisco that probably the most important connection, or one of the most important connections, was made, and that was with the American Indian movement. And we met with Bobby Castillo, who was the member of AIM in San Francisco. And I remember one morning, it was misty and quite cold, and we met on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge with a group of Native Americans, and we travelled out into the countryside with three men, three, you know, of what you would call their warriors, who met us there. And we attended a meeting as we arrived into a community type structure, and we first met with the women to talk to the women about the campaign and talk to the women about Marlowe Morgan as a white American woman who was claiming to have led this walkabout and being the custodian of the, you know, purest form of Aboriginal culture in this country. And, you know, their response was concerning, but of course they themselves had also been subject to massive amounts of exploitation on their culture and non-Aboriginal people pertaining to be, you know, of Native descent and doing similar types of things as what Marlowe Morgan and the New Age movement has, you know, people do. So we had the meeting with the women and we went through all the issues, and that was particularly important for the women who were with us on our contingent, the senior women, in particular like Peggy Patrick. Following that meeting, we then went out a few miles into a different part of the reservation there, and we had got maybe to this point at about 10:30, 11, and I remember seeing this sort of dome-shaped structure that had been made from wood branches and, you know, small tree trunks, and over the dome shape were being placed wet blankets, animal skins, and canvases, and yeah, it was really built up quite thick. And outside of the dome there was this huge fire pit where you could see rocks that were placed in the fire pit. It must have been there burning for a long time because the rocks were actually glistening red, like they were, you know, they were massively hot. You couldn't even see the rock colour. It was just, you know, burning red. So they'd been in this fire pit for a long time. So we were entering what was explained to us as being a sweat ceremony. Some people refer to them as sweat lodge ceremonies. And, you know, we were told by, you know, the main, I suppose, chief and one of his warriors about what to expect in the ceremony and what to do when things become, as he put it, unbearable. And there was in the dome, a U-shaped sort of, I suppose, built. So what we were told to do was to enter in through there, but once entering in there, just on our knees, circulate so that we formed a circle around the big pit that was inside the dome. So that's what we did, but prior to going in, we had to take off all of our clothing, and if anyone had any rings on or earrings or jewelry, in other words, that was all to come off as well. And this was only the men. The women weren't part of this ceremony. This was just for men. So, you know, yeah, basically you go in as naked as the day you were born, and circulated the fire pit. And then what had happened was, as we sat there, the first rock or stone, river stone, was placed in the pit. And the first reaction, because it was a cold morning, was to get as close to that one stone as you possibly could to get, you know, a little bit warm. And then, you know, the second stone came, the third, the fourth, the fifth stone came, and you can start to feel the temperature, if you like, inside the dome change a little bit. And it started to get, you know, a touch warmer. And that's when I remember the warrior singing the first song. And that song, when it was sung, was about battle and going to war. Because I remember him saying that Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull would often say just before battles, like the Battle of Little Bighorn, that, you know, and Wounded Knee, that if today's a good day, it's a good day to die. So, you know, it gave them the confidence, if you like, and built up their courage in which to face the enemy. So more rocks would be brought in, and of course it then became hotter inside this dome. And I remember a pipe being passed around, and at that time I was a smoker because I was inhaling the smoke, although they said not to because it was more a herb than, of course, tobacco. But anyway, it was a pipe that provided the bond, if you like, of solidarity between all of the people within this dome. And more stones were brought in to the point of where you started to realise just how the temperature had changed inside this dome. It was now to a point of where, you know, you were reeling back to get away from the heat. And so more stones were brought in and more songs were sung. And I remember the story then that was told to us, and that was the story about Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. Then there were other things I remember that the warrior was talking about, and he said, look, if you have to leave the dome, you cannot stand up, and you must leave the entry head first, not by your feet or the side of the body. As he kept talking, I started to realise the symbolics of what this dome actually was and what we were actually going through and what the ceremony sort of meant. It was more the symbolics that I was visualising. And so anyway, more stones came in, and he started talking about some of the sweat ceremonies on the Mexican borders and some of the warriors that actually sit within these dome structures until blisters actually erupt and burst out of their skin before they even leave the dome. And some men go through such pain, that's what happens. And anyway, I remember in there, and I would have no guess at how many stones by now had been placed inside the dome, that the old man, Paul Sampi, who was one of the men in the dome with me, said, Rob, I've got to leave. Can you see me right? And it was a relief to me, because it is a test of your manhood. It's a test of your endurance. And that's what these ceremonies are about. And, you know, they have the other ones that they were talking about, where in the middle of winter's most icy and coldest period, you know, some of the ceremonies were to strip naked again and dive into the cold waters, which would be a whole complete different form of pain and what that would do to the body. And then hanging, you know, from the hooks from trees, and, you know, some of their ceremonies were pretty much based on pain and suffering to learn, you know, and to create your manhood. So at that time, when the old man said, I can't put up any longer, Rob, with the heat, can you accompany me out? And I said, yes, I can, Paul. So in keeping with the first advice in terms of how we exit the dome was to go out by head and then crawl out that way, we did. Because one of the things that happened inside the dome prior to leaving and to crawling out of there was you started to try to get through the ground, through the earth, to the coolness of the understories of the mud. That's where the coolness was. And then you start to put it on your body to sort of keep the heat out and to keep, I suppose, or thinking you're keeping cool. But what you were actually doing by putting the mud and the earth over you, you started to bake inside that protection, what you thought was protection. So it actually got hotter. And every now and again, there'd be water that would be thrown onto the rocks that just created these massive amounts of steam, but not enough, obviously, to put the heat of the stones out. So as we left the dome, I remember with the elder just crawling into an open area. It was also muddy and not swampy, but there was a bit of water around and it was just sprinkling rain. And with Paul, we just laid in the mud and the dirt and put our hands into the ground and just try to, I suppose, cool the body for as long as we could. One of the other contingent members, Glenn Taylor, he actually was one of the last to leave the dome. And I remember his words to me before we went into the dome. He said, well, how hot can it really get, Rob? These people have never, ever suffered a hot summer's day up in Three Springs, like where I come from. And I said, well, I don't know, Glenn. These mob are talking about, again, close-to-death experiences through heat and blisters bursting up on your skins. He said, well, I tell you, out at Three Springs, I've been through summers that have got and been really, really hot. So I'm going to endure this for as long as I can. And, you know, to this very day, I often think about Glenn because, yes, he did. He endured that ceremony right up through to the end with the rest of their warriors. So that was one of the greatest honours and experiences that I've had in my life spiritually, was to go through that ceremony and have the absolute respect from those people by not only going through the ceremony, but them explaining to us just what the ceremony was. Because the dome was actually the impregnation of the mother. And as we were leaving the dome, we were actually being rebirthed. We were becoming children. So the ceremony was through the heat that they say is associated with the pain of the birth of a child when a woman gives birth to a child. And that's what the ceremony really represents, the birthing process of a child. One would think that that would be related to women's law or women's ceremonies, but no, men go through it to experience the pain of what women do when they give birth to children. And that to me was a great and a very precious moment in my life and my time. One of our last meetings before leaving San Francisco and returning back to Australia was with the university groups, and they were specifically the Native American units, and there was one group I remember called Skins, and we had a major meeting with the group of students and young people, as well as, you know, some of the teachers and staff of the university. And we spoke to them about the campaign. And, you know, the young people in particular were extremely interested in how we got this campaign together, you know, the protocols, the procedures in terms of unifying the Aboriginal voice in our country to actually go to America with the solidarity of all of our people to campaign and to put up our position on Marlo Morgan's Mutant Message Down Under. So we spent a lot of time talking about issues dealing with culture and obviously their issues and social, political issues that, you know, Aboriginal people here and over there were facing in relationship to just the day-to-day survival. And there was a tremendous bond built up between ourselves and that student body. And I think that was important in sharing that knowledge and information with that group, because what it did was it gave a legitimacy to us supporting each other as Indigenous mobs from one country to another. And I think after and following the sweat ceremony and going out onto the reservation, it somehow consolidated itself in a real meaningful way, because further into the campaign in terms of Mutant Message Down Under in Australia, there was a lot of anthropological views and they contested Dumbutung's right and our protocols as Aboriginal people to fight this fight. And that will reveal itself in the campaign as we talk about it in its next stages. But I think what was important was that there were young people studying high degree courses and, certainly learning about grassroots advocacy in how to put the processes in place to carry out such international campaigns with very little resources and how to connect that and make that work. We departed the USA back to Australia, and the campaign kept its momentum up because by now we had done two major reports on the campaign, which were our Bonyawongi message stick reports 1 and 2, which outlined our campaign into the United States, but also an outline of the book and the ramifications of the book and how the book, you know, was written by a false prophet, if you like. And it was around that time that my oldest daughter, she was at high school. She'd come home one day from school and said, "Look, Dad, why don't you put these reports up on the internet?" And I said, "Well, what's that, Marika?" And she said, "Well, it's, you know, through the computer, and people have websites and other people play games on the internet, and it's a way of communication." And I said, "Well, I don't know, Marika, I've never heard of that." And she said, "Well, you know, it would certainly be a way in which to get out to the masses of people the information about, you know, what you're doing and, you know, where you've been," and you know, she referred to the campaign. So what I did was I rang a company that was in Leederville. I said to them, I said, "Yeah, well, look, what would the cost be?" And so I put that to our committee and they agreed to it. And so we went about setting up our first website. And the website, historically, to this point in time, was and is the first ever Aboriginal website set up in Australia in terms of accessing Aboriginal information directly from a given site. There was, through the Newcastle University, a Aboriginal unit that was running a website, but it was an academic website, really. So, yeah, Dumbutung proudly, you know, boasts to be the first Aboriginal organisation in Australia that mounted a website. And it was not long after that that company formed itself into a company called IINet, which today is one of the, you know, biggest internet servers in the world. And, you know, we were the 32nd customer of IINet. And I've often talked to IINet about that. And, you know, there's story being done about, you know, the historical links between IINet and Dumbutung. So we were then able to get these messages through our reports worldwide. And we had a comment box at the end of the Bonyawongi message stick reports. And it gave the public the opportunity to be able to comment on the campaign, comment on what we had written up in the reports. And these reports were extremely extensive. They were very, very intricate in explaining Aboriginal, the protocols we used, the original trips around Australia to debunk that she had travelled around our country, and right through to where we'd come back from the United States trip and the tour. So we were starting to get major responses that went into the thousands. And that gave me also some indications of just how popular this book had really become worldwide in terms of how many people were responding to that response box. And what that led on to was I got a phone call from some contacts that we had in Japan. Those contacts were from people that were the indigenous people in Sapporo called the Ainu people. And the Ainu people who had visited Dumbutung through the second Kayana in 1993 informed me that Marlo Morgan was on a world tour and that she was going to Japan, and that whether or not we wanted to solicit their support and that of some of their contacts in one of the major universities in Japan to actually, you know, confront Marlo Morgan in an auditorium. And, we originally spoke to them about the confrontation in Kobe City. And with a lot of discussion and, then talking to our committee here and other people involved with the campaign originally, we agreed that we would travel to Japan and we would confront, with the support of the indigenous people of Japan, the Ainu people, and the support group, that we would confront her in Kobe City. And we did that. We travelled, and there was only two of us that went to Japan, myself and Paul Sampi. And we basically were hosted by the Japanese people. We stayed in their homes, and we went through with the Ainu people on arrival into Japan, a salmon ceremony, which meant that, we were in the waters in very thin and long canoe-type dugouts, and we were harpooning massive salmon. But, you would go through a ceremony of how you would prepare the salmon and give relevance to the spiritual connection that they have with the salmon. And that was a most important part of leading into the campaign in Japan, because it connected again, as it was like in the United States with the North American Native peoples, a connection with now the indigenous people of North Japan in a stronger way. So we went through the ceremonies, and then we spoke to their support group, which were Japanese people, but some of them were fluent English speakers. So we started to formulate how we would walk in on Marlo Morgan. We had to make sure the organisers of her auditoriums and her tour wasn't aware of what our intentions were. And in doing so, there was obviously a lot of confidentiality and, I suppose, trust that we had to build up to ensure that this campaign was going to be as successful as it could be. So what we did was we planned it out right through to the last detail, and what was to be said to Marlo Morgan. We had, I suppose, thought through what some of her responses may be. Because, you must remember, we're now in a country where protests, walk-ins, even speaking out about issues is not in accustomed to their types of culture and their type of values. So here were two senior Aboriginal men, in particular Paul, who was, a lawman and of great credence, was, a very, very special man to ceremony. And here we were going to basically bust into auditoriums in major cities. And of course, the reaction is what was to be discussed and judged and thought through by ourselves and the support group. So what had happened was we looked at Kobe City as being the first approach. So what we did was the support group that were working with Dumbutung and myself and Paul started to gather outside the auditorium. This was as people were arriving to listen to Marlo Morgan. And, the expense of the tickets were quite expensive. We were told how much people were paying per ticket and how many people were filling these auditoriums. And, you started then to count into the tens of thousands of dollars equated to American dollars. So the support group was starting then to hand out just small posters of information about the fact that this woman was a hoax. Her story was a New Age fabrication, the truth. It had nothing to do with the Aboriginal cultural way and the way of our people, and that she was a New Age charlatan. And Japan, and in dealing with the campaign, really showed me in many ways how difficult it was to tell or to try to tell people that what you're about to experience or see is actually something of an illusion or delusion. It's not true. And like I said earlier, this is where I started to get the concept of it was really like trying to tell a young child who so much looks forward to Santa Claus coming at Christmas time that Santa Claus doesn't exist. And, we had great opposition in Japan in terms of some of the audience that were visiting the lecture or the presentation. But anyway, Kobe City, we did what we had to do, and one of the support group members went up and purchased X amount of tickets. And, we waited just outside the stage area where Marlo Morgan, was to appear to give her presentation. And myself and Paul Sampi, along with our interpreter, because whatever we were saying in English needed to be interpreted into Japanese so that the audience could understand fully what was being said, because Marlo Morgan was operating with an interpreter as well. So we waited for her to get on stage and to start talking about her experience and, you know, her travels with the Real People tribe, as she puts it, and the Regal Black Swan Elder. And anyway, she enters on the stage, she starts talking, and maybe, you know, 5 minutes or so went past, and I said to Paul, I said, well, we'll go now, Paul. And Paul Sampi went out into that protest on the stage in Kobe City without his shirt, but he was painted with his ochre and also his ochre markings on his face. And he had two massive kylies or boomerangs on each side of his hips that he had brought in from One Arm Point. Because Marlo Morgan didn't expect this to be taking place or even have an idea that we're in Japan, she started to reel backwards. But she did give the space for us to get to the microphone and for us to put our protest across. And when we did and we finished what we had to say, and they were mainly points really about how we come as the rightful and proper custodians of Aboriginal culture. We come representing the unified voice of our people across Australia. You, Marlo Morgan, have done our people so wrong in terms of your lie and deceit about our culture and other points and issues that we raised. Then we left the stage, our presentation was felt. There was deathly silence right throughout the auditorium. And I'd felt that, yeah, we had done what we had gone there to do. That was in Kobe City. So Marlo Morgan's response to the walk-in in Kobe City was pretty straightforward. She said to the audience, because we were listening to it being interpreted, she said, these two Aboriginal men that have come today are not the type of Aboriginal people that I talk about. These two men are full of hate and vengeance against the entire Western world for what's happened to their people in Australia. So they come with a heart of hatred to literally attack me on this stage as they have done in America. Now, we never ever come face to face with Marlo Morgan in America. That was done through other means, by the telephone conversation in Warner Brothers and discussions that we had with, and Marlo Morgan through, you know, Steven Seagal. So, you know, she had told the Japanese people in Kobe City that we had walked in on other venues of hers, which was completely untrue. So what she did was she painted a picture that disturbed that audience, and she started to lose the connection with the audience through basically what she and how she described myself and Paul Sampi. And, you know, I think that done her damage. And we spoke about the issues with Kobe City for a few days until it became her auditorium presentation in Tokyo. Although she wasn't aware and couldn't be aware that we had planned to walk in on her again in Japan, but I've always believed that if we were going to walk in on her in Kobe City, Tokyo being the capital with, you know, millions of more people and her audience capacity, many more, hundreds of people than was in Kobe City, I think she could have hazarded a guess that Tokyo City was on our target as well. So the day of the presentation in Tokyo, myself and Paul and our support group got to the auditorium quite early. We were needing to go through a lot of things because, again, it was a, you know, it was a much bigger presentation that she was giving. And of course, there was all the possibilities in the world that her organisers and those at the door were well aware that this could happen again. And we were, I remember, in part of the building, and we were visited by two Japanese men who said that you should leave the building because the people who are running this particular auditorium aren't people of New Age interests or, you know, social right people to whom believe in humanity and the sorts of things Marlo Morgan is supposedly talking about. They gave us a very clear indication that they were people that were involved in making money. So there was a criminal element to this particular organisation of this venue. So we were moved out of the venue. The support group felt that, you know, that was in our best interests and to keep safe, that we were taken, I think, three or four streets away from the auditorium where, again, we just sat down and pre-planned how we would go about this in the safest way for both myself and Paul. What we came up with were certain decisions, and we went back to the auditorium, and at that time I was playing a bit of didgeridoo, so I played that outside the doors of the stage area where she was given her presentation. And you know, that had created a small gathering in itself. And again, the support group was talking to people about the hoax and you know what we were doing in Japan. We then commenced the walk-in, and I remember vaguely there were a number of media representatives who walked in with us, and this auditorium had thousands of people inside. It was a massive audience capacity. It shocked me, actually. But I stood there, and I had a little microphone on just a small box that one of the support group members, our interpreter, actually brought in with her and was battery-operated, but at least it raised our voice up somewhat. And I started the same interruption to her presentation as we did in Kobe City with exactly the same wording and format. It didn't need to change. So I went through what I had to say, and that was particularly to the audience in Tokyo. And the response was a bit more honourable than was in Kobe City. There was a more, I suppose, sympathetic ear to the fact that it already appeared in the Japanese media that there was this walk-in in Kobe City and a number of Aboriginal people in Japan protesting against this American woman who was given these presentations about her experience with this tribe. So some people in Japan already had linked into and started to understand there was this protest going on. So I felt that inside that auditorium, there was a respectful response and they listened. And then when I finished, Paul spoke to the audience. And the response from Marlo Morgan was completely different to Kobe City. So I then realised that, hazard the guess, she guessed right, was that, yep, we were going to walk in on her in Japan's biggest city, Tokyo, and she had prepared herself for that. So the response wasn't as critical in the sense of myself and Paul having such intense hatred against the Western world and white people, as she put it, in Kobe City, to try to justify that protest against her. What she did this time was she left the stage and she walked up towards us and she stood in front of me and she said, "Take this gift that I offer you." And it was just a one single red rose stem with the rose in bloom. She said, "Take this gift, for as simple as it is a gift of great love to you to balance out and to try to destroy the vengeance of hate that you have." She goes on then to say, "You think you are separate from all other people, but you are not." And then I intervene into her commentary by stating that, you know, our people have suffered, you know, and suffered immensely in our challenge in terms of colonialism in our country. And then she says, "Well, we have all suffered, all races have suffered." So, you know, it went on in that vein for a while. And then Paul Sampi, as she went back to the stage, gave the closing comments to that walk-in. And we then left that auditorium. But what was, I think, really important for the walk-ins did two things. They brought us for the first time since the campaign had commenced, you know, a number of years before, face-to-face with Marlo Morgan. And it brought us also massive media coverage in Japan that triggered off massive media articles in all throughout the Northern Hemisphere, really throughout Europe, and again in the United States. Australia media kept very quiet. You'd need to dig through the Australian newspapers to find articles written about this story. However, the electronic media did cover it in our country. But Japan, I think, really was a catalyst to the legitimacy of the campaign. It really gave the campaign its final apex to Aboriginal people. You know, if we couldn't and didn't have the legal framework, and there wasn't the laws in the Western legal systems in which to define ownership of knowledge or intellectual property, and to fight that in a legal way, Japan offered us at least a jubilant knowledge of the fact that we won what was a massive moral battle against this hoax and Marlo Morgan as a perpetrator of the hoax. Following all of Dumbutung's meetings and our connections with unifying the Aboriginal voice in Australia regarding this worldwide campaign, there remained one person in our whole country that was quite silent in this period and this process. He was a Koori leader. He was a well-known activist. He put the Aboriginal flags into the White Cliffs of Dover, and his name was Burnham Burnham, and he was from Sydney. Burnham Burnham at one time met Marlo Morgan in Sydney, and the story that we learnt was that, you know, they communicated, and a number of things happened. Burnham Burnham joined Marlo Morgan on her lecture circuits in the United States, and actually in her auditoriums, she introduced him as the actual regal black swan elder that led the tribe she called the Real People. So Burnham Burnham was quite known around Australia and different parts of the world, put this acknowledgement for the book and for Marlo Morgan in the preface of the book. And this letter reads as such.
I, Burnham Burnham, an Aboriginal Australian of the Wajeri tribe, do hereby declare that I have read every word of the book Mutant Message Down Under. It is the first book in my life's experience that I have read non-stop from cover to cover. I did so with great excitement and respect. It is a classic and does not violate any trust given to its author by us real people. Rather, it portrays our value systems and esoteric insights in such a way as to make me feel extremely proud of my heritage. In telling the world of your experiences, you have righted an historical wrong. In the 6th century, the Dutch explorer William Dampier wrote of us as being the most primitive, wretched people on the face of the earth. Mutant Message uplifts us into a higher plane of consciousness and makes us the regal and majestic people that we are. Letter from Burnham Burnham, a Wajeri elder.
So when you listen to the letter and you read between the lines of that particular acknowledgement and that verification of Burnham Burnham's, he uses the plural we. And when he talks about the real people, and he all but associates himself within that tribe. So as we said, when he went to America, he was introduced onto the lecture circuits by Marlo Morgan as the regal black swan elder. When we eventually got back to Perth after the American tour, I was sitting in Dumbutung with Paul Sampi, the one-armed point elder. And I was talking to Paul, and this is where we first brought up the Burnham Burnham implication, and the fact that there was this one Aboriginal person to whom laid claim that the book was to be true and honest in its descriptives, and as he says, it uplifts the majestic qualities of Aboriginal people. Paul Sampi was pretty distraught at this letter and Burnham Burnham's involvement, and he asked me whether I had a phone number for Burnham Burnham and that the time had come to speak to Burnham Burnham about his support for Marlo Morgan and the book. And I said to Paul, no, look, I don't, Paul, and it would be pretty difficult to get a phone number. I'd need to trace one down through some of my contacts in Sydney. However, there was an old telephone telex here and we hadn't used it for some time, and I just took the chance and picked up this telex and went through it to the B section, and there was his name, Burnham Burnham, written, penciled in by lead pencil with a phone number with the prefix of Sydney 02. So I rang the number and I said, I'm ringing to speak to a man named Burnham Burnham. And the reply straight away was, oh, is that you, Robert, from Dumbartung? And I said, yes. He said, look, you know, I know and I've been waiting for this phone call. And I have been viewing extensively the campaign and the work that you've been doing on Mutant Message Down Under. And then he broke down and he said to me that, look, within the next couple of weeks, I'll write a letter to yourself and the senior elders and I will explain my thought and my position. Can you give me that will to do that? And I said, yes, I can. And myself and Paul Sampey will receive it and we'll read it and then we'll make it public. So the conversation ended and Burnham Burnham then wrote this letter, which was received at Dumbartung in 1996, and we'll read that now.
Letter from Burnham Burnham to Mr. Robert Eggington, campaign spokesman, and Mr. Paul Sampey, Bardi Tribal Elder. 15th of February, 1996. Dear Robert, please convey the following messages to the tribal elders and law keepers concerned. I, Burnham Burnham, hereby sever all ties with the author, Marlo Morgan, and the book entitled Mutant Message Down Under. My reaction to the book was an innocent response to what I considered an account of an inner journey which uplifted Aboriginal Australians in the eyes of the world. In my innocence, I did not understand the tribal ramifications of my support for the author. I am a non-tribalised, non-initiated, non-traditional, urbanised Aboriginal man from the east coast of Australia. Yours sincerely, Burnham Burnham.
So that was a letter in which we received from Burnham Burnham, and it was a major part of the campaign, but also the success of the campaign, because now what we had noted was not just Burnham Burnham's withdrawal, but other things that were happening in America that started to chip away and have crumbled this hoax and this position that Marlo Morgan held in and on those lecture circuits in America. So it was important to get that admission from Burnham Burnham. And I think what may have been really important and must be said was that Burnham Burnham actually passed away around 3 weeks after we received that letter through natural causes. So it was really an important part of some of the final outcomes and appeared prominently in what we called the Bonyawongi Message Stick Number 2 report on the Mutant Message Affair. From there merged some connections back to a academic in Canada who had got in touch with me before we even went to the United States. And he was a professor of English literature and he was head of Australian studies and theatre in the Acadia University in Nova Scotia in Canada. And his name was Professor John Eustace. And he initially asked, you know, because he was following the Marlo Morgan and the Mutant Message Affair, as he put it, for all the years that it was running. He said that he remembered years before typing into the internet to do research on this book, because the book was handed to him by an associate in Canada at the university, knowing that he was head of Australian studies, and was told to read the book and see what he thought about the book. So, of course, he read the book and he was appalled by the book and all that it indicated and represented. And so, therefore, he typed into the internet, Marlo Morgan Down Under, expecting the first articles to come up on the website would allude him to the book and maybe some of the information on the book. But it actually led him to our Bunyawongi message stick reports. So what he did was he was so enthralled with the fact that the campaign had got really to this point now in Japan. He had done two papers in which he published in the literature journals, and one was titled Plastic Indians and Cowboy Affairs, and the other one was about the Mutant Message Down Under campaign. And he said he got incredible responses back from both those papers. They were probably the beginning of the territorial anxieties of universities and anthropologists and archaeologists trying to protect their realms of territorial control. And that is the nature of our life and our culture as Aboriginal people globally. So he rang me, and our first conversation really was about the papers. And then he said, you know, I've been studying the campaign and I want to know if I can seek your permission. He said, but I think it may need for me to come to Australia. He said, I've never been to Australia. I need to come to Perth to talk to you about the possibilities of actually writing a book on the campaign. He said, because it's not only extensive in terms of what you've achieved and with very little resources. He said, it is an incredible story that many, many people need to know about. And I know that when I give papers to the literature journals and write up in different journals in different universities in the United States, it really doesn't give the right justification or indications of what you've done. He said, so I would like to write a book. So I want you to think about that for a while. The book would be a shared reference to any type of commerce value that it will generate. And there would be a complete total memorandum of understanding between myself as the author and Dumbutung as the organisation that mounted the campaign. Because he said, this is your story. He said, it's not my story. He said, and it even somehow embarrasses me in terms of my position as a white man in the world of academia to now be writing about the very things I teach in as being obstacles of concern to your rights of freedoms as being Aboriginal and the knowledge and all that constitutes within that. He said, you know, this is a massive, complex issue, he said, but it needs to be done. But he said, and I appreciate that you would need time to think about this. So I'm going to call you back in a couple of weeks and see what you think. Is that okay? I said, yeah, John, that'll be okay. The phone call then ended. And I said to Selena, you know, look, there's this high-profiled academic who's head of Australian Studies and English Literature and Theatre in a place called Nova Scotia in Canada, who now wants to write a book on the campaign. And he wants to come over, or he's thinking about coming over to Perth. And I spoke it over with Selena because, of course, we were battling this thing in terms of our intellectual property, and that wasn't just really in the New Age movement. Of course, it was in the world of academia and through anthropology and a lot of processes that we're just taking from our people and our life and our culture and, you know, studying it and researching it. And so the conclusion that me and Selena came up with, well, if the memorandum of understanding is such that it protects our rights and our position on the agreement, well, maybe the way forward is to give him permission to write the book. But of course, we would oversee the book and how it basically takes direction. So John called me back. And I remember saying to him, well, look, we agree to the fact that you can go ahead and write the book. So what he did was he took a sabbatical leave. He came to Perth. He was based at the University of Western Australia to carry out the research. He came to Australia to research two, as he put them, phenomena. One was the Marlo Morgan affair and the campaign, and the other was research on Ned Kelly. And he got the right to actually access some archived materials within the Melbourne Museum in terms of the last letters in which Ned Kelly wrote to, I think, his mother in Ireland or, you know, relatives in Ireland about what happened to his sister. And the police and how this whole sort of confrontation with the police and the Kelly family erupted in Victoria. So I found that interesting. And it was from that sabbatical and that leave and that time that John Eustace had met our family. And he came on two sabbatical leaves, actually. So he eventually went back to Canada after meeting and coming down south. And we went through our sites down there at Dryandra, the red gold clay ochre sites. And we went through the Dryandra forests and then down through the Valley of the Giants at the Carrie Valley and Bluff Knoll, and, you know, massive, big and beautiful country down in the southwest. So we got John as close into our country as it was possible. We also arranged for John to meet with some of the elders that did go across to the United States with us. He met also with some of the support members within different universities in Perth that were, you know, supporting the book. There was a anthropologist at the Burnt Museum, John Stanton, who wrote a inclusion into our Bunyawongi message stick reports, which was an anthropological perspective on the information in which Marlo Morgan used in the book. That was considered to be of a sacred nature, but that particular anthropologist had stated that she could have accessed that type of knowledge from any anthropologist pool or even any local library in that reality. He then went back to Canada after those extensive visits here, and he obviously commenced to write the book. And I think it was a year or two that passed, and I hadn't heard anything back from him. He then rang me and said that in writing the book came across some depression, and he called it writer's block, and then said how, I think it was his daughter and his wife for Father's Day bought him a guitar. So he was able to, you know, play the guitar. So some of the creative juices, as he said, started to flow. And so therefore, he then picked up the pen and got back on the computer and concluded the Japanese leg of the campaign, therefore then completing the book. And the book was called Old Battle, New Age. And the book was a really defined testimony to the campaign. It gave all of the relevant indicators and recognition to what Dumbutung went through in relationship to bringing this whole scandal that, as we said earlier, was as prominent as was the hand that signed the paper by Domenico and the Celestine prophecies, Marlo Morgan's mutant message down under should be and should have been internationally analysed, if you like, and critically condemned by media around the world, as were those two books. Talking about one with the Auschwitz experience with the Ukrainian family that this woman said she was part of, but she was actually a Australian. Her name was Helen Day. And the other one, of course, by Redcliffe was the one that was to do with his travels into Peru and what he had said he had spiritually, you know, experienced encounter, which was, again, another hoax. And it was there that John Eustace stated that Marlo Morgan's mutant message down under should have had as much international criticism through all forms of media as was those other two books written. So from there, John Eustace found it just absolutely humanly impossible to get the book published. Not even the university in which gave him his sabbatical leaves, which is his own university in Canada, being the Acadia University, nor UWA, which have all got printing presses. And he had gone to Mugabulla Books, an Aboriginal publishing house here. We went to IATSIS, which is the Aboriginal and Islander Studies units based in Canberra, to see whether they would be and would find it of interest to publish, because they archive all Aboriginal knowledge and Aboriginal issues. They've got a massive library and archival sectors. He went to Fremantle Press, John Pilger, the great documentary maker who made the first Australians and produced Utopia, sent it to a company that he works with in London called Zen Publishers. And every single publisher that had read the book and then assessed the book for publication refuted the publication of it. And that really was a damning point in relationship to even further suppressing the Aboriginal story, further suppressing our right to tell our story our way and to protect, in the way in which Dumbutung did, our intellectual property and cultural ownership by this huge international campaign run on not just a very stringent budget, but where people were hosting us because we didn't have the funds to pay for certain parts of that campaign. So it even showed further, I suppose, the political will of people to actually, again, deny us our right to have our voice heard. So it was during the first lot of COVID lockdowns in Australia that I looked at Selena and we spoke and I said, you know, Selena, the book is still in its manuscript. It's not being published anywhere. What do you think? She said, well, no, I don't know. She said, maybe, you know, we've got a generated income account where we've, you know, spent many, many hours of our time delivering conscious training programs, and some may call cross-cultural training programs, and donations where people have donated to Dumbutung. And what we decided to do was to approach a printer in Perth that we knew and to see whether, because of the nature of businesses slowing down during COVID, the first lockdown, of whether and what type of quote he would give us to publish this book. And they came back with a quote, and me and Selena then made a decision to actually publish the book under Dumbutung funding. So the book then became a reality, a hardcover copy to hold. We had put magnificent photographs throughout the book, so, you know, it indicated a visual magnificence, really. And the way it was laid out in terms of pages, and it was a piece of art in its own right. Then we gave a tribute to the book in the memory of our loving son, to whom we lost in 2009, and the book now is tributed to our son, Bobbo. A comment that many, many people asked during the campaign and following the campaign was why, whether this story was falsified or a true story, why did it really have a bearing on Dumbutung campaigning against it? If it was a story that, you know, again uplifted Aboriginal people and gave reference to our knowledge, and people wanted to hear, and some of their lives changed through that knowledge and that information, why is it important that the campaign stop that knowledge from being put out there? You know, it was difficult to get people to comprehend and to accept a very simplistic reality, which was, if we want to change this world that's broken and gone wrong in so many ways, and we want to heal that for the better, you can't heal that through lies and deceit. You can only make that difference of the conscious change through the truth. And the truth was what Dumbutung, our people, and this campaign fought for. It was the truth of our cultural knowledge, the truth of who we are as people, and our right to tell our story to the world in a way that we could tell it through the wisdom of our old people that was based on their truths. And the truth is the only process in which we can change this world into a better place for the next generations. May our campfires burn forever.